Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Heard around the state on Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, a shooting outside of Washington prompts calls from Utah politicians for greater security. Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke recommends shrinking the Bear's Ears National Monument. A Utah Muslim leader is left stranded in Kenya and more. And joining us in studio for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr in the flesh today. Good morning, Tommy.
Hey, good morning. Howdy.
Thanks for being here. Government reporter Courtney Tanner, welcome to you. Good morning.
Thanks.
Justice and safety reporter Taylor Anderson. Welcome, Taylor, a debut appearance.
Hey, Roger.
And Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke, a veteran of these airwaves. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, the old-timer here, huh?
We also want to hear from you during this Friday morning news wrap-up. Weigh in on the stories that we're covering today and post your questions and comments to sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. You can also call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. As usual, a variety of stories to get to today. Let's start, though, with what has been happening in the wake of the shooting that took place on Wednesday morning during a practice for an annual congressional charity baseball game. Five people were injured in the shooting, among them House Majority Whip Steve Scalise. The gunman who police shot and killed appears to have had political motivations for this shooting. And Thomas Burr, Washington Bureau Chief, a kind of shocking, frightening moment just outside of D.C. this week. And you know, I mentioned that the shooter appeared to have political motivations. You wrote this week about some members of Utah's congressional delegation calling for added security for members of Congress after this. And as part of that, your reporting touched on the fact that some of Utah's members of Congress have received threats themselves.
Yeah, in fact, I mean, this is not the first shooting of a member of Congress, obviously. I mean, just recently, 7 years ago, Gabby Giffords was shot in the head outside of Tucson at an event. And yes, members of Utah's delegation have received death threats. And that goes back a long time. Senator Orrin Hatch received death threats in 1993 and actually got deputized as a U.S. Marshal, like deputy U.S. Marshal, so he could carry a gun around and protect himself. And more recently, though, Congressman Jason Chaffetz, I was talking to him about the shooting and talking about the death threats, whether he thinks members of Congress should have security. And he told me about this guy in Florida who threatened him and actually was charged with a crime. And it turns out this guy had left a voicemail on Congressman Chaffetz's congressional office saying pretty much, I'm going to wrap a rope around your neck and hang you from the nearest lamppost.
Wow.
The guy was actually charged with a felony. He's awaiting trial. I talked to his lawyer. He's got some mental health issues. But that's not the only one. They're rarely prosecuted because, you know, you have to make an overt threat. It's not just, you know, you should die. It's going to be, I'm going to actually kill you kind of thing. But there are many members of Congress now, because this has actually hit home for them, this is one of their own, that are calling for perhaps U.S. Marshals to, you know, be with members of Congress when they're doing a town hall in Provo or something like that. Local police often steps in, but what about their homes? Congresswoman Mia Love, just recently, some woman kept driving by her house and taking pictures of her kids, and you can pretty easily find people's addresses these days.
You know, I think it was Mia Love who actually pointed out that in the interview that you had with her, that if it weren't for the presence of House Majority Whip Scalise in this security, you know, having his security detail with him, the shooter could have kept on shooting in this particular instance. The idea is that some members of Congress who are in specific positions do have a detail that goes around with them. Is that something that, I mean, it would be impossible for every member of Congress?
No, of course, only leadership has a security detail. For example, Senator Orrin Hatch, as president pro tem, has 23 people. So he has round the clock, two people with him, maybe three people with him at all times, no matter where he is. But only leadership has that. So, yeah, you're right. I think there were 22 members of Congress who were at this baseball practice. And normally they would have no security, would have no police, no Capitol Police at all. So if not for Steve Scalise being there, you would have had possibly a horrible rampage and several members of Congress could be dead.
Has this shooting, and really it's the latest in a long line of tragic American shootings, has it led to any additional conversations about, especially in Congress, about gun control?
Yes, of course. And some people were trying to say, please, let's not politicize this. But it only took, you know, what, an hour, even less, for people to start talking about gun control. And I talked to several members of our delegation about that from Utah, and the response was pretty much, well, this means that I really will use my concealed carry more, or this is why we should be carrying guns, and not to control them, but to have more of them, the whole, you know, good guy with a gun stops the bad guy kind of thing. On the other side, of course, there's plenty of people who are saying, like, this guy had, you know, a clip that he could shoot 50 rounds really quickly kind of thing, and we shouldn't be allowing that.
Mm. I want to quickly remind listeners that you can join this conversation by calling us 801-355-8255. You can also comment at sltrib.com. And I want to bring in Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Gerke on this conversation. And Robert, is this act of violence something different than what we're accustomed to? I mentioned the sort of political motivations, you know, apparently of the shooter. Is there something to be said about the American political system, American democracy, or is this just another shooting in America?
Well, I mean, I think it's clear that we live in a pretty polarized time, and there are, you know, there's only so much you can do to sort of weed out mental illness. There have been instances where people have, who are unhinged, kind of go off and do these things. And it's not just shootings. You know, we had the anthrax scare at the Capitol when I was back there. And you know, these things do happen. You can't, no matter how many steps you take, you know, what efforts you take, there will be gaps, I guess, in the security, and these things could happen. I think it's probably a healthy discussion about how we interact with each other, how we couch our debates, whether we do it civilly or whether we use inflammatory language and so forth. You know, by all indications, I guess this guy was apparently a Bernie Sanders volunteer. He came from the political left. We've had, you know, the Gabby Giffords is obviously a Democrat who was shot down in Arizona. I don't know if they ever actually connected that to a political motivation per se, just somebody who was mentally unstable. But, you know, so it's a discussion that's worth having. We live, again, in very polarized times, and we probably need to try to think about the words we use and the words we say.
Well, you would think that something like this and everything that you just mentioned might be a deterrent to people who might otherwise consider getting involved in public life. And Tommy has I'm kind of wondering, just circling back around to conversations that you've had with Representative Jason Chaffetz, could these threats be part of the calculus behind his leaving Congress at the end of this month?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there's many reasons I think Congressman Chaffetz is actually going to step down from office. I don't think this plays into it. However, he has hired his own private security before, so out of his own pocket or out of his campaign, he was doing a campaign event. Congresswoman Love told me how she set up a whole camera system and alarm system at her house. You know, they're taking these steps because they're concerned about this, and probably rightly so. But yeah, we live in a situation where the rhetoric is so inflamed right now, and it was that day you saw several statements that were just inflaming it more. And at a time when we're all calling for unity, and people are still just going to the mattresses on what they're saying.
Hmm. You know, last we heard, Scalise was in critical condition. Is that still the case, Tommy?
That's what I understand. President Trump visited him at the hospital. It sounds like the bullet entered his hip, but then bounced up and hit several organs as well. It's not a good situation. He's had several surgeries, from what I understand. Okay. You know, and Steve Scalise, I recall, was when Mia Love first came into office, he was one of the first people to come to her office and congratulate her and bring her a little gift. He's friends with obviously all of our delegation, but particularly close with Congresswoman Love.
Okay. Well, you guys, there's still quite a lot of news to cover on the show today, and so we'll have to leave these tragic events here for now. But Tommy, thanks for your reporting on this. A reminder once again that you can join this conversation with your comments. We'd love to hear from you. The number to call is 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Let's turn now to government reporter Courtney Tanner, who wrote the story of a Utah Muslim leader who has been prevented from returning to the United States from Kenya. And Courtney, just to start off with, this is a U.S. citizen we're talking about. His name is Yusuf Abdi. He's a local imam and activist. What happened in this story?
Yeah, so Abdi had gone to Kenya to kind of collect his wife and his five children, and they were allowed onto the plane, and Kenyan officials kind of pulled him aside and said, hey, we're not going to let you on. The U.S. doesn't want you to come. But yeah, Abdi is a U.S. citizen. He's a legal immigrant. He came here about 10 years ago and got his citizenship. So,
And he was traveling with his family. As you said, they were all of them were permitted to board except him. Some of them themselves weren't U.S. citizens, though, despite the fact that he is. I mean, it's just sort of a something to point out there that one person who is a U.S. citizen is being prevented from getting on. Others who aren't are not. Is there does this have anything to do with President Trump's travel ban or attempted travel ban, I should say, affecting people coming from Muslim-majority nations?
You know, Trump's travel ban shouldn't have any effect on this. I mean, the courts have kind of blocked that order, and Kenya is not one of those seven Muslim-majority countries. But according to these officials, that's kind of what the impetus was behind keeping him in Kenya.
Okay, and so do we know... I mean, Kenya's not on that list, and the airline, though, told Abdi that the United States was rejecting him, saying that he wouldn't be allowed to enter. That's correct?
Yeah.
Do we know the reason for that apparent rejection by the United States?
Well, so United States officials weren't involved in this. This was just kind of the airline saying, we don't think the U.S. is going to accept you when you get there.
He's not being held in Kenya, though, right?
He's not detained.
There's a group here in Utah. It's the Refugee Justice League, a group of lawyers who came together not all that long ago, in fact, in the wake of President Trump's first attempted travel ban. And one of their lawyers is working to try to get Abdi back home, correct?
Yeah. Jim McConkie is, you know, talking to the senators and the embassy and the Homeland Security to try to get this U.S. citizen back to Utah. Hmm.
You know, I don't know. Maybe I'll turn to the columnist, Robert Gierke, on this again. Is this about, we don't really know, but is this about the Muslim community being targeted or about?
Well, it certainly looks that way. And if it's not part of the sort of broader sweep of you know, rejection of refugees and so forth, then it's a strange coincidence. As you mentioned, the good news is that he's got these attorneys working for him, and they do it on a pro bono basis. And I love their name, by the way, the Justice League. It reminds me of, like, superheroes.
Yeah.
But you know, I guess that's what we need now, are a little more superheroes in the world. And they're trying to work on his behalf, and hopefully it gets resolved in a favorable way fairly quickly.
I mean, again, we don't know the reason for why he's being prevented, but especially since he's an American citizen, that's got to challenge. I mean, it almost seems illegal to prevent
it. Certainly on the face of it looks illegal. I mean, and so we don't, again, as you mentioned, we don't really know exactly what the rationale is for doing this. But, you know, as citizens of the United States, you're entitled to certain rights. And one of those rights is to, you know, is travel like that. And they'd have to have a pretty good reason, one would imagine, to keep him out. Being Muslim doesn't cut it. And so either there's some miscommunication or, you know, we'll have to see how this plays out. But again, I guess the positive in this is that he's got representation. He's got this group working for him. And I think this group is doing some pretty important work right now. And we, you know, we need that kind of representation in the, given the times, that, again, that we're living in.
Okay. And Courtney, his family, you said, that, you know, they were all allowed to board. Have they all arrived in Utah? It's just him who remains in Kenya.
Yeah, to my understanding, they're all here. I mean, his wife and two of his kids were on visas, and the other three had passports. So they're technically not legal immigrants, but they're here and waiting for him.
Well, we will see where this goes next. Right now, though, we do need to head to our first break of the show. Stay with us. There is more to come. You are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, joined by Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Courtney Tanner, Justice and Safety reporter Taylor Anderson, Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr, and columnist Robert Gierke. We are discussing the past week's local news, and you were invited to join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. Well, Thomas Burr, earlier in the week, some big Utah news that came out of your beat in Washington, the recommendation by Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke that the Bears Ears National Monument be shrunk And Tommy, not really a surprise here. You were on a press call with Secretary Zinke. What did he say about this decision?
Yeah, so this isn't a surprise. 45 days before that, President Trump had ordered a review of all national monuments, but with specifically the 45-day window, he had to report back on what to do with the Bears Ears National Monument that President Obama had named on his way out of office. And I think everyone expected either he was going to recommend to rescind, get rid of the monument status altogether, or shrink it in some form. So when we understood that he was going to shrink it, and he talked about how there are treasures there they want to protect, and then kind of punted some of it to Congress, saying it needs to be up to Congress to add some wilderness protection or conservation area protection to some parts of the monument. What Zinke did not do was go into details. So he was very much a broad, you know, first draft kind of a report back saying, it went too far in the monument designation, which is 1.35 million acres, and we should not do that entire thing. Let's just protect the areas we really need to protect, and then leave it up to Congress.
He didn't say, you know, for example, how large this monument should be now, or okay,
no numbers. So you know, we've heard various things, and I don't really want to report it because it's not confirmed in any way. But you know, it could be shrunk to, you know, several hundred thousand acres versus 1.35 million. Or it could just be 1 million and cut around.
Well, you touched on this. Utah's delegation, I'm imagining, was leaning towards a full rescission of the monument.
Rescission is the word, I think. Revocation,
I like it. This is not that, but to conservation groups, you know, it might as well be. Any. We don't know what the size of it is yet, but or what the suggested size of it is yet.
Sure.
But saying we're going to modify the monument at all is equivalent to getting rid of a lot of protection in their mind.
Yeah, I mean, even if Zinke recommends to shrink it to 1.3 million acres and the president does that, there are going to be lawsuits filed. And I think the lawsuits are already being drafted at the moment.
It's not, I mean, what it comes down to is that it's not necessarily legally possible for the president to now do what Zinke is recommending, or for him alone to say, I'm going to now, you know, but the stroke of the pen say this is shrunken.
So former presidents have changed the monuments from their predecessors before, and that's actually never been tested in court. But it may be around, say, the Grand Canyon area that's changed a little bit before it became a national park. That's never been challenged, but no president's ever revoked a monument status before. So we'll again, this is all going to be there will be a court battle, I can guarantee you right now.
So this could be kind of a test case of sorts.
Absolutely, because the Antiquities Act, which gives the president the power to name a national monument, does not specifically give the president the power to revoke one or change it necessarily. So what we'll see is taking it to court and saying, does the president have this authority to change something that was done by a predecessor? And in many ways, it will be interesting to see whether the court gives deference to the former or the current president.
Mm. Again, 801-355-8255 to add your voice to this conversation. Congress, though, does kind of have the power to change monument sizes or to, you know, revoke or, I guess, adjust them. They rarely, if ever, do that. Might they listen to Zinke's recommendation? It'd be kind of a challenge to executive authority, right?
I should actually know this, but I don't know the last time that Congress actually created wilderness.
Robert Gerke?
I'll jump in here because, yeah, I mean, Congress changed the boundaries of the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument, and they also did. They also authorized some land swaps of Sitla land out of the monument. So they've done that within the last 20 years. And also, it should be noted, I guess, that all of our national parks started as national monuments that Congress then came back and changed into national parks. And so, Congress has the authority to do this. And as Secretary Zinke recommended, you know, he thinks they need to clarify the boundaries and designate some national conservation areas. National conservation areas are an interesting beast because they're not really defined in law, and they kind of end up being whatever they want them to be. It's sort of ad hoc, fly by the seat of the pants kind of designation. So they do want to. I think this is what they're going for here, is they want to involve Congress in this process as much as they can, because that strengthens the legal argument that it's not just an executive action, it's not just the president undoing it, it's Congress involved in this as well. We've got this further review that Secretary Zinke is going to be doing, and it looks like we're probably going to be out into maybe fall before we actually see any final recommendation going to the president on this.
You know, a number of tribes had lobbied for this monument. How did they respond to Zinke's recommendation, Tommy?
You know, I think a lot of them saw this as a slap in the face, that this is the first national monument designated at the urging of tribal leaders and tribes across the country. And it wasn't, you know, there obviously were several tribes around the region who did it, but nationwide there were so many tribes that joined in supporting this. And this discontinues some of the feelings towards the federal government that tribes have about broken promises.
Secretary Zinke was kind of trying to throw a bone to tribes, if I understand, by talking about co-management of whatever shrunken monument again would survive under the scenario that he's advocating. How did tribes respond to that aspect of it?
You know, I think it's a wait and see kind of situation. But already, when President Obama named this monument, he set up a kind of a commission, the tribes we part of, to help suggest what could be done on the lands. Well, Zinke, you're right. It is a bit of a bone to toss to them, is to say, well, Congress could set up a situation where there is actually by law co-management, not just kind of a advisory committee to doing this. But again, I mean, Congress can barely pass a budget these days, and they certainly didn't pass the Public Lands Initiative last year that was supported by Utah's delegation in a Republican Congress. So could they actually go back and do something on this? That's a good question.
Hmm. You know, we're waiting. You know, you mentioned this. That it's almost a foregone conclusion that this will, whatever happens, this is going to hit the courts. In the meantime, what happens to the land that is within the boundaries of the monument as it was declared? We haven't seen a management plan. Because that would essentially be the interior's responsibility, right?
Yeah, management plans take a while. Let's just remember, this is all federal land before, so it's nothing really has changed. I don't even know if there are signs up now the same monument yet. So nothing has really changed on the land. Management plan is going to take a while anyway, but that's definitely going to be slow played right now because there's no reason to do a management plan when it all may change in a few months.
I'll just note that there are guidelines, interim guidelines, after monuments have been designated, sort of a and really, all that changes is it's maybe a little bit more difficult to, you know, expand roads or to patent mining claims or things like that. Existing mining and oil and gas that was there before still can be done, but if you want to go in and do new stuff, it makes it more difficult. So that's where it stands right now until there's some sort of final action on it. And one of the interesting questions is, you know, as you mentioned, it's going to end up getting challenged in court. Will the environmental groups, will the Indian tribes be able to get an injunction to prevent any changes to the interim status during the pendency of the court case while it's making its way through the, you know, so that'll have some impact on how this land is managed probably for the next couple years.
Hmm. You know, if under a national monument, though, you would imagine that if somebody were to go in and be, I mean, this would be, I'm sure, the case anyways from a law enforcement perspective, but looting or involved in some sort of activity that wouldn't normally fit inside of a national monument, wouldn't there generally be somebody there kind of keeping an eye out for that? Right now, that's not happening.
Well, and that's one of the things Secretary Zinke noted, is that there really isn't the law enforcement presence there. And there aren't, you know, he made a big issue of them needing bathrooms down there. I don't know that that's priority number one, but I don't know.
More porta potties.
Maybe, I guess, if you need a bathroom, it is priority number one.
Yeah.
But it's this issue of, yeah, the law enforcement presence there is pretty sparse, and it's getting a lot more traffic now that it's getting all this attention in the media. And so from what we understand, the visitation down there is really spiked, and there's not more of a presence down there to sort of safeguard these things from, you know, being looted or inadvertently destroyed. I mean, you can just be, you know, you can have the best intentions and still mess things up.
If I can just add it, this is obviously a big issue here in Utah. It's a big issue for the Utah delegation. And obviously the Interior Secretary is paying attention to it because he was ordered to do so. In the Trump world, this is not even on the radar. Hmm. I mean, he's got a few other issues going on.
Right.
Maybe if the Russians were interested in it, they would be. We also need to watch what they're going to do with the Grand Staircase, because that's sort of the next shoe to drop, right? I mean, he's got another 45 days, I think, to make recommendations on the remaining.
It was 120 monuments. Days from April 26th, and I became a journalist because I can't do math, so whoever can figure that one out.
So that's in the works, you know, is reviewing all of these other big monuments. And you know, we've heard, obviously, this is, as Tommy noted, this is not confirmed. We don't have any idea of this is where this is going to end up, but anywhere from 100 to 150,000 acres is what they're kind of looking at in that ballpark, which means 90% of this monument could be wiped out, you know, sort of within the coming months.
Right. Okay. Well, the story goes on. We wait to see what happens and whether that gets confirmed, for example. The Tribune, KCPW, and I'm certain Utah Public Radio will keep you posted on this story. But right now, I want to pivot kind of drastically here from a national and San Juan County-specific story to a Salt Lake County story. And we haven't yet heard from Taylor Anderson, who covers justice and safety for the Tribune. First off, Taylor, thanks for being here. It's great to finally have you on the show.
It's good to be here, too.
Among other things that you've covered this past week, the ongoing story of Salt Lake County recorder Gary Ott is there. For well over a year now, there have been concerns about Ott's state of mind, his mental health, and as a result, how his office is being run. And some recent updates to the story include the fact that Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams has called for Ott to retire. We learned this week that something it could happen, that's something that maybe could occur. Is that right?
Well, that's what he has an exempt secretary who's kind of acting as a caretaker, and they may most likely are roommates as well up in Weber County. And she kind of, I guess, is a public face for Gary. Nobody that I know of has talked to him in several months. Ben McAdams, the county mayor, said he hasn't even talked to or, I believe, seen him since last year. So she actually, Carmen Ott, is the caretaker and exempt secretary. She offered up his potential resignation if the terms were right. So that's out there, and the county council, I believe, is weighing that, but they won't say publicly.
Right. And the, I mean, this is something that was floated. She floated this idea of his retirement it was a county Republican Party chair but the details of that are a little bit interesting because he's not speaking for himself, as you pointed out.
Right. Yeah. Jake Parkinson is the Salt Lake County chairman, and he confirmed that he talked to Carmen, wouldn't say what it was about. Carmen offered herself, Carmen Sinone, that it was about Gary's potential retirement maybe before the end of the year. His current term doesn't end until 2020, so this would be a few years early. And so she said that she offered to Jake Parkinson to go to the Salt Lake County Council and say, if the terms are right, go ahead and start discussing Gary's early retirement or resignation.
Terms being, the idea being that Ott himself could get a better retirement if he survives long enough in the position, or negotiating the terms of his retirement. Is that
presumably
correct?
Although one of the shifting stories throughout this whole saga is that Carmen Sinone has said that the talks of the early retirement are all about getting funding for this piece of software and for the Salt Lake County Recorder's Office. That's what this is all about. So if the county council will agree to fund this piece of software to help the office do its duties, then maybe Gary will resign because that's a good term for him. And they would also talk about health benefits and salary as well.
Some negotiating points. This is kind of a hard situation for everyone involved, and there's been talk in the past about finding a legislative solution that would allow for the removal of elected officials in the case of mental incapacity. And there was a bill just this past year to do that. It didn't get anywhere. Robert Gerke, you've seen a lot of the legislature's workings over the years.
I've seen a lot of mental incapacity at the legislature.
Is that the fix, though? I mean,
I was surprised that they didn't pass that bill because everybody's been talking about this, and there's got to be some mechanism for them to address these issues. You know, it's one of those situations where a constitutionally elected officer can't be removed without them taking themselves out of the mix. And so, and it's fascinating watching Carmen negotiating on Gary's behalf. Nobody's really clear on what authority she has to do that. You know, she's been his, I guess, caretaker of sorts, you know, presumably for the last year or so. But, you know, she doesn't really have legal authority to kind of go in and negotiate in his best interest. And so, you know, it's a terrible situation where I don't know that people necessarily have Gary Ott's best interest in mind. You know, he's clearly needs he appears to be struggling and needs help, and I think that should be everybody's first priority. But I think, you know, the taxpayers are maybe not being served, you know, the way they should be because of his incapacity.
I'm just moving past the, you know, his specific situation. It, you know, long term is conceivably making the recorder's position an appointed as opposed to an elected position a fix here.
No, I mean, it doesn't necessarily. We need a better fix, because what happens next time if it's the mayor? You know, what if Ben McAdams is incapacitated and, you know, and refuses to step down? Or what if it's a city, you know, a city official? You know, there needs to be some sort of mechanism in place for these kinds of issues to be addressed. And, you know, yes, making the recorder an appointed position is, I guess, ostensibly a sort of solution, but it's really not. It doesn't address the fundamental underlying problem.
Hmm. Taylor or Robert, if Ott were to step down in the near future, what would happen to his office and his position?
Well, I think my understanding is that it remains a Republican seat, and the Republicans would then in Salt Lake County would then fill that seat. You know, and that's, I think, one maybe part of the discussion as well, that the Democrats would maybe like to have that seat. It's not a, I mean, let's face it, it's the recorder's office. We're not talking about highly politicized, you know, positions, but it's not something that, you know, they want to give away. So, you know, and I think, you know, maybe that's part of what is motivating this McAdams call to make the recorder seat an appointed seat. You know, again, it's not a highly politicized place, but there are discussions about who's going to fill it and who would be in charge.
Okay, well, you know, years of service from the county recorder, from Gary Ott, and again, just an unusual and tough situation. Taylor, thanks for this update on the story. Right now, guys, though, we do need to take another quick break. We'll be back with more from this past week's news in just a moment. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stick around.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For podcasts and more local shows and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio. I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Courtney Tanner, Thomas Burr, Taylor Anderson, and Robert Gerke. You're invited to join us with your comments and questions during this Friday morning news wrap-up by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page. I want to turn now to the special election to replace outgoing Representative Jason Chaffetz in Utah's 3rd Congressional District. Chaffetz leaves in about 2 weeks' time now. There are nominating conventions this weekend, tomorrow actually. Some debates have been taking place and continue this evening. Courtney Tanner, the Salt Lake Tribune, issued a questionnaire to candidates. And, you know, just because there are so many candidates, there's no way to ask about how every one of them responded individually. But there are sort of broad takeaways here, places where, you know, say every Republican agreed or every Democrat agreed. There's also some points of divergence. Tell us, you know, I don't know, for example, maybe we can start with Republicans, where they agreed. An obvious place to start might be healthcare.
Yeah, the Republicans all kind of agree with this effort to repeal the Affordable Care Act, but they don't really agree on what they want to replace it with. So some of them say, you know, let's do a free market system. Some of them say, let's turn the control over to the states as far as insurance coverage. Hmm. So there's kind of different opinions there, but they all agree that it needs to go.
Kind of in lockstep saying repeal and replace, the mantra we've been hearing. How about the three Democrats? They probably don't want to see that happen.
Yeah, the Democrats, they all agree that Obamacare has some problems, but they kind of also disagree on how to fix it there. So two of the Democrats, Ben Frank and Carl Engwell, want to see this kind of single payer, they call it Medicare for All system, and Kathy Allen's more into let's fix what already exists, you know, let's add more provisions to it just to make Obamacare better.
Okay, and the other two are asking for essentially a different kind of repeal, and replacing it with single payer. Going back to the Republicans, the Tribune also asked them essentially about their opinions on the current president, on President Donald Trump. What was their response?
Most of the Republicans kind of gave this qualified, little lukewarm support that said, oh, well, I like Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch, or I like this specific thing that he's done. Only one Republican came out and completely disavowed Trump, and that's Shane Roe, who's a newcomer to the race.
Okay. But some diversion tactics from other Republicans who don't want to necessarily claim him, but neither throw him under the bus. Was that a question that was asked of the Democrats as well? I'm assuming that they all had the reject Trump.
Yeah, every Democrat pretty much disapproved of everything that Trump's done.
And then as far as the Russia investigation and probes into potential obstruction of justice by the president goes?
Yeah, this on both the Republican side and the Democrat side got some varied answers. So some people said, you know, this whole thing's a distraction. Some people said, you know, Russia didn't meddle with any clear goal. Some people said that, you know, we should work with Vladimir Putin and actually resolve the situation. So it kind of jumped around for both parties there.
When will we know who the nominees for each of these parties are? Just this coming weekend?
Yeah, so the Republicans actually already have two people that have qualified for the primary ballot, and that's Tanner Ainge, who's an investment advisor, and then Provo Mayor John Curtis, and they collected signatures, so they're on the ballot. And then the party will also pick one other person, probably, likely, and then the Democrats will pick one person this weekend as well.
Okay, so, sorry, there will be a runoff for the Republicans? Is that what you...
Yeah, there will be a primary. There will be at least three people in that running.
Okay, and two of them, as you said, have already gotten through due to a law from a couple of years back, the Count My Vote law, which has been part of the sort of contentious part of Republican politics in the past couple of years here in Utah. Is that something that is still being challenged? Maybe that's a question for Robert Gerke. Is the Republican Party still trying to get rid of it?
Yeah, they're still in the appeals court, and there's some talk that they might be brokering a deal to get rid of that legal challenge. But yeah, for at least as far as this election goes, we'll have the we'll have the three Republican candidates on the ballot, and I think August, is it August 19th is
August
the
15th,
primary?
Yeah.
And this is a highly Republican district. The odds are, I mean, if you were a betting person, that
it's one of the most conservative, most pro Republican heavy districts in the country. And so, even though there's probably some Trump backlash and maybe some baggage that might be, you know, we were seeing that in the Georgia special election that's coming up. Even though that's, you know, it's gonna almost certainly remain a Republican seat.
Okay. I want to turn again to other stories and another drastic turn here. Go back to Taylor Anderson, who is actually a government reporter at the Salt Lake Tribune. I've been misidentifying you the entire hour. Taylor, there was an announcement this week that an area called Bonanza Flat, this is a canyon area at the top of Big Cottonwood Canyon, I believe, is going to be finally protected. Tell us about this.
Yeah, it's actually been private land for... I don't even know how long, for a long time, but it's been used as like a public open space. It's at the top of Big Cottonwood Canyon. A lot of Salt Lakers go up and hike around, snowshoe, ski, whatever. It's a pretty popular area. I'm pretty sure you can bring dogs up there, which is kind of a rarity in the canyons. And it's for sale. It's been up for sale for several months, I believe, and the sale price was $38 million. There was Open Lands Advocates started a fundraising push to raise that, to buy the land from Wells Fargo so it didn't get developed. It's kind of prime real estate for high-end luxury sort of resort development. So because even though it's been private, it's been used as open space. There was a lot of appetite by Open Lands Advocates to raise that $38 million and get it. And just last night, I guess, a final donation came in, $165,000 to make it happen. Yesterday was the closing deadline, so success.
And so the land is purchased for preservation is the idea. And the proposal had been to build condos, to build a resort, as you said?
Yeah, my understanding is there was Park City had was first in line to buy, so they had the, I guess, right to refuse purchasing the land if they didn't get enough money. And I think number two was some sort of developer who has built luxury high-end resorts in the past. So the presumption was that's what they were going to do up there.
And Salt Lake County had a hand in completing this deal as well.
Yeah, they did. Several public entities contributed public money to make this happen. That's why it was actually pretty interesting. Park City voters passed a bond for $25 million, and then Salt Lake City, Wasatch County, Summit County, all these different entities chipped in as well. Salt Lake County initially turned down on a 5-4 vote to contribute $3 million. So it looked like it was dead, but we're in the middle of mid-year budgeting for the county, and I guess something happened behind the scenes where they brought it up through this tourism recreation fund where they had an extra $1.5 million that they thought, you know, could be used statutorily for this effort, and there was kind of a late push, some wrangling. We won't go into the details on how they got it done, but it just passed last Tuesday. They have to finalize it next Tuesday, but they made it happen.
The gist of the thing is that it is done. Okay, well, that's an interesting story as well from Salt Lake County, and thanks for your reporting on that. And since we have both Tommy Burr and Courtney Tanner here in studio, I kind of want to circle back around to some reporting that's been coming out of Washington over the past week, and just close out, because there was a vote to sanction Russia. This was a Russia sanction story that Courtney Tanner reported on this past week, and almost all members of the Senate voted in favor of these sanctions, except for two members. One of them was a Utah member of Congress.
Yeah, Senator Mike Lee. So this was just an amendment to kind of a larger bill that included sanctions also on Iran. But this amendment was putting sanctions on Russia for kind of cyber attacks and interference in the 2016 election, and Lee was one of the two to vote against it.
What was his reasoning for not voting for this these sanctions?
There's a small provision in the bill that appropriates $250 million to kind of allocate to different countries and some non-governmental groups, and he didn't agree with that allocation.
Tommy Burr, this the kind of backstory here is, of course, this has to do with Russia's alleged tampering, tampering, I guess, in the—
I don't think it's alleged anymore. Yeah, I think it's pretty much clear the Russians were meddling.
In the 2016 election. And this is something that the president is now, because of— it's tied to an investigation that's going on by special counsel. The president is under investigation for obstruction of justice related kind of to this. Maybe you can give us the background here.
You know, there's a drip, drip, drip every day of news stories coming out about this. But yes, the Washington Post is now reporting that this investigation has reached the president and that he is actually being investigated for obstructing justice because one of the reasons being he fired the FBI director who was overseeing the investigation beforehand. There's so many little levels of this. Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, is now being investigated as well for some business dealings, apparently. The president tweeted this morning going after the deputy attorney general who really has been kind of supporting him in this whole thing. It's just they keep going after each other. The president pretty much confirmed on Twitter this morning that he is under investigation.
You know, I feel like there are two parts of the story that we kind of lump together. One is the investigation into election tampering. The other is potential ties between the Trump campaign and Russia in the run-up to the election. And then sort of thrown a side part of that is the obstruction of justice, which is just for the action of the president in relation to one or either of those. You know, how do we keep these things separate, Tommy?
And you really can't keep them separate is the thing. They're all one investigation. And remember, in Washington, it's the cover-up that always gets you. It's never really the crime sometimes, because the crime is harder to prove. It's the cover-up when you start doing some things that get you in trouble. That happened with President Clinton, for example, when he lied under oath. And you know, slapped with the perjury charges, at least in the impeachment. In this situation, yeah, so the investigation started Russia's meddling, and then it moved to, well, were Trump associates involved in that meddling? Did they know? Did they support it? Did they have conversations about it? And now it gets to that is there a cover-up situation of firing the FBI director to stop the investigation that may ensnare some of Trump's associates?
Okay, and this investigation by the special counsel continues. You know, we'll see what happens, guys. I'm realizing that we're low on time, and we probably ought to turn pretty soon to our underplayed stories of the week. And so, if anybody's ready with one, I'll throw it out there. Robert Kirky, are you ready with one?
I'll jump in and go first. Everybody's favorite polygamist, Lyle Jeffs, was arrested in South Dakota. Tommy's got Utah roots, so he knows some more polygamists than with the rest of us, I guess. But he was arrested in South Dakota. He'd been on the run from the law for a long, long time, but was busted trying to pawn a pair of pliers. You know, so now the FBI took him into custody, and we're going to actually see some closure to this To this chapter, at least, in the polygamous saga.
Just quickly, was he busted trying to pawn a pair of pliers because the pawn shop person recognized him?
No, they asked for ID, I guess, to prove that he was who he, and he showed them the ID, and they're like, oh, wait, you know, it's, you know, I guess when they ran the ID, it came up, oh, hey, this guy's wanted by authorities. And
what's the going rate for pliers at pawn shops these days?
You know, I think it said $37.
Wow.
So,
oh,
nice. And he was wanted for a food stamp fraud case for his involvement in this alleged food stamp fraud in the Utah-Arizona border community that he lived in.
Yeah, and he'd been on the lam. I can't remember how long, but it's been a long time. They've been looking for him. Yeah.
More than a year, I believe. All right. Well, Robert Gerke's underplayed story of the week: the capture of Lyle Jeffs. Tommy Burr, are you ready with an underplayed story?
Sure. We started talking about this at the beginning here: the shooting of Steve Scalise this week, where Republicans were practicing for the congressional baseball game, which went on last night, which I thought was pretty awesome. I usually actually go to this game every year. I didn't go because I'm in Utah right now.
Right.
But it's a lot of fun. The Democrats won 7 years in a row. Last year when I was there, the Republicans won, and the Democrats won again last night. I think it was 11-2. And they play at National Stadium. It's really neat. But I think it was just impressive to see the show of unity that came out of that. They may fight each other on Capitol Hill, but they can go play a charity, you know, baseball game, even in the wake of a tragedy, and kind of unite each other, which I think is important.
Also noteworthy, the Democrats won something. They've lost so many elections lately. It's good to see them actually get a win.
All right. Okay. So the congressional charity baseball game, and actually there was charity. Who was the beneficiaries of that charity?
They usually have several, like Boys and Girls Clubs, you know, food banks. They have several different ones. I think they raised like $1 million though this time, like twice as much as they usually raise.
Okay. Courtney Tanner, underplayed story of the week.
Yeah, government reporter Lee Davidson did this interesting story where Utah was ranked on how many women officials were elected to office, and we ranked 46 out of 50, so we got an F grade for electing women.
And 46 out of 50, and this is just because of the makeup of our state legislature, is the idea?
It's just women elected throughout the state in different positions.
Who fared worse than Utah?
I'm not sure.
Maybe West Virginia. I don't know. I don't want to characterize. But
is there a suggestion in there? I'm sorry, I didn't actually get a chance to read this. Is there a suggestion in there of what could be done to get more women to run for office, to get more people to run for office?
I will say that there's this Real Women Run group here in Utah that's sort of trying to encourage women to run for office, and we have an opportunity, I guess, this week with the, you know, we've got I think 3 women who are running for this congressional vacancy. On the Republican side, and I believe there's at least one on the Democratic side. And so, you know, there's an opportunity there to see those numbers shift a little bit. But yeah, I mean, it's a slow process, and the Utah legislature remains, I believe, 80% male, 75% male, which is pretty overwhelming.
All right. Well, we'll see if we can make some improvements there. How about you, Taylor Anderson, an underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, it's probably the election everybody's watching in South Salt Lake, the mayor's race.
Yeah.
We have a government intern who wrote about the mayor's former super PAC. She was running the super PAC, I guess the director. She was also a city contractor who made several $100,000 a year. Some of the mayor, Sheree Woods' opponents, brought this up, and now it's a campaign issue. So it was
benefiting being sort of playing both sides, being behind government and being maybe benefiting from that position.
Yeah, they were suggesting maybe it was a little bit too cozy of a relationship for a contractor to have with the mayor.
And I think she acknowledged. Didn't she say, yeah, you know, it was too cozy, and that's why she stepped down as the super PAC director. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially.
Okay, that is Taylor Anderson's underplayed story of the week. For my part, I'm going to go with some accolades. Actually, I have a couple of underplayed stories since we have the time.
Here we go.
The reason that Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr is here in person is that last night he was honored with an award. And honestly, the Tribune took home quite a few awards last night. Society Professional Journalist Awards, Utah Chapters Awards given out last night. And Tommy here received the Clifford P. Cheney Service to Journalism Award for defending fellow journalists as president of the National Press Club, among other things. That included drafting a letter to then-President-elect Donald Trump calling for continued press pool access, the de-escalation of anti-reporter rhetoric, and improved FOIA, that's Freedom of Information Act, request response times.
I think we got one out of three of those.
Yeah. Some from this request. And that's some First Amendment defense from Tommy Burr there. And Tommy, once again, congratulations.
Thank you. I will repeat the line I started with last night, which is, let me reintroduce myself. My name is Tommy, and I'm not an enemy of the people, and neither are you.
Well, is it a great accolade for Tommy? And you were president of the National Press Club until, what, about 4 months ago?
Yeah, I left in January. It's a one-year term. It was a hell of a year last year to be president of the National Press Club, and my successor is also having a hell of a year because, obviously, the attacks in the media have not stopped, and it's good that we can be a voice for journalists worldwide out there.
Okay. All right. Well, congratulations once again, Tommy Burr. And for my second underplayed story of the week, I'm going to go with one having to do with the Lake Powell and Bear River pipelines. Emma Penrod published a story this morning that says that Utah is proceeding in its planning, its budgeting plans, with including those in a document that would fund those. It's part of the Envision Utah process, if I'm not mistaken. I'll have to double check online. But you can find that at sltrip.com.
And I believe there is also a letter written to the president urging some funding for this as part of the infrastructure program.
From Utah's delegation.
Which is a controversial move just because of, you know, this pipeline is still kind of unproven, I guess, in a lot of ways. So, yeah, watch that one and check out Emma's story.
Absolutely, at sltrip.com. Well, all right, we've got Thomas Burr, Courtney Tanner, Taylor Anderson, Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune. I want to thank you guys all for joining us on the program today.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines. A special thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW. Also, Tom Williams, Spencer Holsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen manage the broadcast at Utah Public Radio. Thanks, as always, to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts of this program at our website, sltrib.com, or however you get your podcasts, whatever platform you use. You can also find KCPW on our social feeds. We are at KCPWFM on Facebook. On Twitter, we are at KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Be sure to join us once again next week for the show. Thanks for tuning in. Have a great Father's Day weekend. Happy Bloomsday to you James Joyce fans out there.